On this episode of the Fear Me Out podcast, I'm very happy to welcome Peter Michael Deeds onto my show. I actually met Peter on Facebook. He invited me onto his podcast, the Transcendent Minds podcast. And we had a really lovely conversation. I enjoyed speaking with him so much that I wanted to do a podcast together. So we decided to do that. We're going to be talking about living in the present and other issues. So I hope you enjoy this episode with me and Peter Michael Deeds. There are two basic motivating forces, fear and love. When we're afraid, we pull back from life. When we're in love, we open up to all that life has to offer with passion, excitement, and acceptance.
Coming to you from our studio in Santa Barbara, California, this is the Fear Me Out podcast. We're not your typical self-help program. Our show takes a deep dive into those psychological issues that affect us on a daily basis. We hope to shift your perspective and have you experiencing emotions differently. Now, Dr. Dana Saperstein.
Welcome to the Fear Me Out podcast. On today's episode, I'm really happy to invite Peter Michael Deeds onto my show. Peter and I met actually through Facebook, and he was gracious enough to have me on his podcast. And it turns out that from my perspective, we're brothers from different family. We really had such a lovely time talking to each other. Peter is an incredibly bright, really passionate guy who really loves being of service to others. And we just had so much fun talking to each other, so I figured I would have him on my podcast, and we would talk about all kinds of different stuff. But what I would love, Peter, if you don't mind, is for you to give my audience an idea about who you are, and then we'll go from there.
Well, as you said, I've got a deep-seated passion for helping people, for helping individuals really discover their true potential and to align with their authentic selves. And my journey as a deep fusion facilitator and coach really began with this seated passion, because over the last 30 years, I've delved into various modalities of personal development and found that deep fusion offered a unique approach that resonated profoundly with me. And now, as a deep fusion facilitator and coach, my primary role is to guide individuals through a transformative process that combines elements of facilitation and coaching. So it's important that to note, because people may get a little bit confused between those two things, is that while facilitation and coaching share common goals, they operate in very distinct ways. So if you just allow me, I can just explain briefly, is that facilitation in essence really involves creating a safe and supportive space for individuals, because when you create a safe space, it becomes a brave space so that individuals can evolve and explore their inner worlds, their emotions, their beliefs, and their experiences. And it's really about enabling self-discovery and accessing their inner wisdom and facilitating their journey towards greater awakened awareness and growth. Now, on the other hand, coaching often involves a more structured and goal-oriented approach. So the focus is usually on setting and achieving specific objectives, where you identify, what are their goals, and creating action plans, holding them accountable for their progress. But with deep fusion, what I'm in my journey and in my practice, I decided to go beyond those traditional boundaries. It's more of a holistic approach that combines the best of both worlds. So I work closely with clients to create a safe and nurturing environment where they can explore their inner landscape while also setting clear intentions and goals. I prefer promises rather than goals, because people tend to break goals, but it's harder to break a promise.
Right.
So it's bridging that gap between self-discovery and goal achievement. And it's often recognizing that true transformation often occurs when we harmonize those two aspects of our actions. Because when we integrate the insights gained through self-exploration into practical actions, that leads to a profound and lasting change. So in essence, I am guiding clients to fuse their deepest insights and emotions and self-awareness with their external aspirations and goals. So that results in much more of a holistic and transformative experience.
That sounds pretty amazing, actually. So, Peter, how'd you get here? Tell us a bit about where you come from. And obviously, in the United States, we would recognize you as having an accent. You probably don't see yourself that way. But I would love it if you could just take a few moments and talk about how you got to that that incredibly insightful place that you bring to the people that come to see you.
Well, it was quite a journey, Dana, quite a journey.
Where were you born, Peter?
I was born in Kent in the UK. My ancestry is Greek.
Okay.
And I have a great affinity for Greece and for Egypt and beautiful countries, you know, when we take aside all the politics and all the opinions of you know, the Middle East and Egypt. It's a very rich culture, and they're great civilizations that have a lot of knowledge, and I feel very connected to those two civilizations.
Okay.
But I went through a process of wandering, actually. I felt very nomadic in my very younger years. I didn't follow the traditional 2 and 2 equals 4. In other words, it wasn't go to college, go to uni, get the job, you know, fulfill the economic imperative, have the 2.2 kids, get the white picket fence, and then lose consciousness after 70 or 80 years. I wasn't on that trajectory for some reason.
Okay.
I was absolutely captivated by culture, different cultures. So around, well, when I was young, when I was 17, 18, I got married and I lived in the US actually.
Oh.
Because she was in the US Navy.
Uh-huh.
And I lived in Oklahoma for a while in a little town called Enid.
Wow.
In the middle of nowhere.
I was going to say.
And what I remember about Oklahoma, it was so flat. And this was way back in the 70s. And it was the first time I'd been to the States, and you know, I was overwhelmed by all my TV and all my shopping, and you know, we didn't have that in the UK. I think we had 3 channels, stores closed on Wednesdays, half day, nothing was open on Sunday. We didn't have the same range of products. And I think it was the vastness, and also it was, you know, back then. And it's no different now to what I've experienced, because my cousin lives in LA, is that the hospitality of people was incredible. I experienced great hospitality in Oklahoma. I also experienced a bit of racism as well.
I went
to the bank and went to this 2-street town to cash a check my cousin had sent me. And I had very long hair at the time, and I'm olive skin, and obviously it was very hot. I was much darker, and they wouldn't cash my checks. They thought I was Native American. I had to get my father-in-law to come down, and they were like, "Oh, Gene, oh, yeah, hi." And he's like, "This is my future son-in-law. What the hell's going on, right?" Yeah. And anyway, that was a whole story in itself. But I went on from that, and I just traveled to Morocco. Because after 2 years of being married, it didn't last. You know, do you know what love is at 20?
Not like you do at 40.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it was more of a, you know, it was my first girl, it was my first love. And, you know, we did gel in lots of ways, but, you know, when it goes beyond just the attraction,
yeah,
you can't, you know, when you marry somebody or you're in love with somebody, you can't just love the bits you like. You've got to take on the whole package. And there were parts of the package that she didn't like, I didn't like. So, you know, what happened, despite my father trying to bring about some kind of reconciliation, because, you know, Greeks don't believe in divorce at that time.
Right.
You know, it was all about mending things and having open and respectful dialogue, all that sort of thing. But it didn't work out. I was very impulsive when I was young. Too many hormones, I guess, running around my system. Yeah. But I just decided to travel. And, you know, I went and lived in Morocco for a while. I hitched all the way from north of Morocco all the way to the southern part of Morocco, a place called Sidi Moussa Aghlou. And I met the Berbers there, and I was interested in why they were nomadic. And I traveled to places, you know, to the Gambia in Africa. I lived in lots of different places because I think, you know, it was almost like, you know, in the 60s, there was the Afghan trail.
Yeah.
I felt like I was on my own Afghan trail, but recognizing in later years that home is in here.
Right.
It's not anywhere out there. But at the same time, I was curious because I led a very sheltered life. And it was very Greek Orthodox, very much protective. And I do understand why. You know, I do understand that my parents were thrown out of Egypt during the 56 Suez Crisis. You know, the soldiers knocked on the door at 5 in the morning and they just said, out.
Wow.
And as soon as they stepped out of their door, the property and everything in it became the property of the Egyptian government.
Wow.
And so...
So your parents lost everything.
Yeah, so they lost everything. And they came to... They went to Australia, but it was too hot because my great aunt was the matriarch of the family.
Wow.
And then they went to Canada, and then they came to the UK. And my father's cousin told me a story that when he arrived in the UK, they were at this center somewhere, and my father was sitting there, and his cousin Costas said to him, my father said, "Where's the food?" And Costas said, "Mike, you have to go and get it from it's self-service." And my father's like, "What?" I mean, he didn't understand that concept because they had servants, not in terms of a class type thing. You know, it was more that was part of the way and style of that time and that culture.
Oh, okay.
So he had servants, you know, in Egypt, in Alexandria. You know, and Alexandria was the home of many, many Greeks. You know, Greeks called it their second home.
Oh, okay.
And he loved Alexandria, but he worked for the British government at the time, so he had a British passport. He came here, he settled here, and it was a very strange upbringing because at home it was I felt like a Marco Polo of people because it was like a United Nations at home. You know, the friends of my parents were Syrian, Lebanese, Greek, Italian, French. And then you step outside your front door and it's very British.
Right.
And, you know, my father sent me to private schools and I couldn't get on with the whole curricula and the culture, really. I found it very, very challenging. The food was awful compared to Greek food at that time. I mean, now it's very different in the UK. So I struggled. I really struggled to find my own mind because I felt caught between two worlds.
Yeah, it sounds like it.
And consequently, I just wanted to wander. I didn't want to because I felt the impressions that I was taking on were the same repetitive impressions, like being in prison. You know, you're seeing the same wall, you're seeing the same people.
Right.
You know, no wonder they don't rehabilitate, because the impressions they're taking in, they're just repeating everything that's gone on before in their own minds. And then they're in this confined space. So I felt like I was in this sort of planned confinement and I needed to break out. But really, I needed to break in. But yeah. I had to break out first to find in my own mind.
Right.
So by actually being in these different places and being with different cultures, I started to absorb all these different teachings and understandings about how people live.
Interesting.
You know, when I was in the Gambia, they would walk several miles to get water. I would walk with them. It wasn't like here, you turn on the faucet
right.
and water just comes. No. And so when you have that understanding, there's a certain humbleness about life and also a gratitude about what I do have.
Right.
And what we do have, you know, living in the UK or living in the US, it's like, oh my gosh, we have all these things. We don't have to walk 3 miles to get water. And, you know, I learned also about pace. So in Africa, for instance, I was in London mode. So I was very much hyped up and very, you know, my foot was on the gas. And you go into this environment and everything is like brake pedal. It's like more serotonin based, you know, people are relaxed and people just let things be. And, you know, I'm talking about daily life. Obviously, if there's an uprising or something, it's totally different. But there was a certain way of life that was slower, more intentional, more purposeful. Because I guess, you know, on reflection now, most of their lives were based on maintenance aspects, maintaining their lives.
Right.
So they had to conserve energy and the heat, of course. So after all of that, all the traveling that I did, I came back. I still wondered. I didn't really know what to do with my life. I had no idea. Because, you know, at that time, you were presented at school with, do you want to be a doctor? Do you want to be an architect? You know, do you want to be an engineer?
Right.
It's not like today, hey, I want to be a digital creator or I want to be a coder or, you know, it's totally different today. And none of those appealed to me except I wanted to be a policeman. So I applied to the Mounted, the Canadian Mounties.
Hmm.
But I was too short and I had flat feet and I was asthmatic at that time. So I couldn't.
So they wouldn't take you.
My application, it wouldn't go through. So I shelved that idea. And then it was a very strange thing, but something said to me, go and do this course. Go and do this degree course. So I did a degree course because I was interested in health and well-being. So I did a degree in health and well-being and fitness for 3 years. And that was a great discipline for me because at school, I found school very, very difficult. It was a challenge because I wrote too much. My language was too flowery. You know, it says Peter has a brilliant mind, but he doesn't follow the curricula. But when I went to college, it was totally different because it was like coursework and thesis. And then I was free to write all these things. And,
right.
and there was this unfettered versatility that I could humanize into application with my work. So I was in the library every day while everybody was partying. And so I came out with distinctions and all the rest of it. I thought, right, now what? Now what do I do with this?
Yeah.
And then I was going to a gym at the time, and I just said to the manager, could you give me a job? I'm at college, could you give me a job? And he said, well, the only jobs we have is a receptionist. I went, I'll take it. So I took the job, and I had a little sort of window, because it was like a local authority gym, like a community gym, not one of these, not like you see today, these big gold gyms and Planet Fitness. And I was just counseling people at the window. helping them with their workouts, their mindset, all the rest of it. I was just trying to serve them in the best way that I could, besides taking, you know, processing their membership and all the rest of it. So then I got a job in the gym as a trainer.
Okay.
And then I started working with people, but I realized by doing that, I was really working with people's mindset. It wasn't just about passing them a dumbbell or saying, you know, or being what I call a good rep counter.
Yeah.
One, two, three, you know, not
right.
that.
Right.
So I developed a whole fitness assessment room so we could get more scientific about, you know, body mass index and flexibility. And I've had all these protocols in place, a lot which I learned from the American College of Sports Medicine.
Right.
Right. So I brought all of those on board, and that really elevated everything. And so I got promoted again. And then a friend of mine, he moved to Philadelphia, and then he went to LA, and he said, "Hey, Pete, listen, the Marines here are doing training in Beverly Hills. They're doing personal training for clients in Beverly Hills as a kind of a side hustle." I'm like, "Well, I'll start that here." So I started it here.
Okay.
Right. And I took an ad out in the Times newspaper, which was about £1,500, which I didn't have. But you got billed 30 days later, so I took that risk. And it was just like, get the body you want for the life you lead, personal fitness tuition, cool, right? So I'd run home every day and check the answer machine, which was tapes at the time, right. These little tapes. And I was just thinking, oh my gosh, right? What, you know, is this going to happen? Is somebody going to call? And then 2 weeks later, there was a message. And it was an American couple. And they called. And they said, "Hi, would you like to come over and see us? We're really interested in your offering. We read about it, you in the Times." I went, "Yeah, okay, great." So I was like, yes. And unbeknownst to me, they lived in Millionaires Row.
Okay.
It's a place called Bishop's Avenue in Hampstead in London.
Uh-huh.
So there I went in my Honda Civic, 13-year-old car. I pitch up. A butler answers the door. There's a Bentley Mulsanne in the driveway. Huge house, electric gates, you know, like they have in Bel Air, or
right.
It's a bit like that, but UK style, right? Butler comes out, I go in, long story short, they're both in California. They were staying in this gentleman's house, and they said, "We want to give him a present, something, because what do you give the man that has everything?"
Yeah.
You give him a trainer.
Oh, okay.
Right? So they gave me a check for twice the amount that the advertising cost me, which I was like, yes, fantastic. next thing, they sent a car to pick me up. I went to meet him at Liverpool Street. He was a top trader.
Oh.
And from there, I worked with him 5 a.m. in the morning, 3 times a week. And then it was like an old boys network. I started like seeing all these others. Plus, I was working in the gymnasium from 10 a.m. So I'd see everyone from 5 till 9, and I would scoot back to the gym and work with clients there, work in my JOB there.
Right.
My father was like, don't leave your job, because he was very much one of those away people rather than a towards person,
because
he was an accountant.
Yeah.
You know how away people are, the accountants are, they're a bit like
living in
fear. The entrepreneurs, like, because the entrepreneur goes, "No, let's do it. And then they fall down a hole. And then the away person goes, "Yeah, I did tell you so."
So right? Somebody who was very careful, obviously.
Very careful. But I didn't really listen. I just went, "No, I'm going to take the chance." And I did, you know, and my yearly salary, I was doing 10 times what I was earning a year. And then I got a studio. We've got a studio in London, in Park Lane, you know, which is really top of the line at the Hilton. We converted it into a studio, and it all went from there. And then I started seeing really famous people. I won't mention names, but really famous people. They would come along when they were filming in London from the US. And because it was in Mayfair, I could charge huge amounts. So that bought me my first house, and, you know, that went on. But then after that, the crash of 1990s happened. And then I lost everything. I absolutely lost everything, the house, everything.
Wow.
I had nowhere to live. And that's happened to me a couple of times in my life. But I, you know, I shook the dust from my feet and went, okay, it's a challenge. So what do I do? What's the solution? Because what I try to, on reflection, what I did then is what I do now. So I don't try to solve the problem. My attempt is to dissolve the problem. So by dissolving that problem into a manageable chunk, I was able to pick myself up, realign, and start again, which I did. But something was nagging at me. And so I started exploring Eastern techniques, mindfulness and shiatsu. I became a shiatsu practitioner, a Reiki practitioner, because I was much more curious about these types of protocols that they would use for healing. So I wanted to heal.
Right.
I didn't think that then, but I just felt that intrinsic part of my nature. And boy, that was a journey in itself. And then I went to things like Landmark.
Right.
I don't know if you've heard of Landmark. I went to Landmark to do their courses, and I ran into so many issues with them because I had so many questions, and I found it too authoritarian, which reminded me of my father a little bit. So I got out of that. And I went from there, and then I went to a 3-week program called The Art of Satipatthana, which means the art of mindfulness.
Oh, okay.
And at that time, I trained as an Olympic weightlifter because I was trying to get into the LA, I think, 94 Olympics. I can't remember, one of those.
Okay.
And so I was, you know, I was fit and strong and all the rest of it. And a girlfriend I had at the time said, you know, you really ought to come and meet my father. He's a Roshi. I said, oh, what the hell's a Roshi? She said, oh, that's a teacher. I went, okay, what does that mean? She said, it's meditation practices. So I went to Wales, and I went there, and I was there in my leather jacket and my Versace pants and Versace shirt and all Ray-Bans and all the rest of it. The lady that meets me at the train station, she's in this sort of fluffy cashmere, sort of purple sweater and baggy trousers. And I'm thinking, oh my gosh, what have I stumbled into? And she hardly said anything to me. Anyway, I get there and I had to wear loose fitting pants, no shoes, loose t-shirt. I brought all those things with me. And I had to wear a hara belt, which is this belt you wear around your tantien, as the Chinese call it, the lower part of your abdomen, your energy area, energy power area. So I wore that, and then I went to see the Roshi, and I knocked on his door, and he's sitting on the floor, and his Irish setter is sitting on the sofa. And to my mind, I'm thinking, shouldn't you be sitting on the sofa in the on the floor? Right? Anyway, this gentleman is in his, probably in his late 70s, 80s. And he's sitting cross-legged on the floor in this robe. And I sit down, and I really didn't know what to expect. This was a completely new world to me. I had no idea. Anyway, I took the plunge, and he said, you think you're strong, don't you? I went, yeah, I trained to be strong, of course. Ego, ego, ego. Of course I'm strong. So my ego was sitting on the throne of hubris at that point. And He gets up effortlessly. And he brings his arm out like this, otherwise known in martial arts as the unbendable arm.
Oh.
And he said, what I want you to do is I want you to put all your force on it and bend my arm. And I'm thinking, size of my arms, and you're elderly, and you're elderly and your arm's really thin, and there's no way, you're not going to break your arm. So I thought, I'll humor him. So I just kind of started, doing this. He's going, no, put your weight on it. So I put a bit more weight on it. And I'm thinking at the time, I really don't want to break this guy's arm because I could have. So he said, no, put your whole weight on it. Now, I was over 250 pounds at that time.
Wow.
Right? I was a big guy. Short, but big. So I did. I can tell you, Dana, I was sweating buckets trying to bend his arm.
You couldn't do it.
And he was standing there, cool as a cucumber. Anyways, and he sits down and he said, you have to realize strength is not here, according to his bicep. It's here.
Right. Yeah.
And I thought, oh, okay. And then he said to me, I said to him, so what do I do now? He said, are you hungry? I said, yes, of course. He said, well, go and eat. I said, then what happens next? He said, then you wash your bowl. Okay. I'm expecting this sort of long explanation of how the day is going to go and what's going to happen. No, it was all about mindfulness.
Oh, okay.
So for 3 weeks, he gave me enormous tasks, being in silence, carrying paving stones from one end to another. I'm talking heavy concrete paving stones, picking up little pieces of gravel and putting them in a bucket, which drove me completely bananas. Right? Trimming herbs, which drove me bananas.
Yeah.
Clearing a forest, which I did barefoot. This is September in Wales. Do you know how cold it is? And peeing down with rain. And I was doing it till 3 a.m. I thought, I'm going to show you. I'm going to clear this forest.
Yeah.
I'm not a quitter, because people were quitting
right.
The program. I was not going to quit. I sat in meditation. We got up at 5 a.m, went to a lake, washed all these key points on the body. And then we sit in meditation. We do all these exercises. My leg sitting in meditation, I've never felt anything like it. I couldn't feel the lower part of my body.
Wow.
And he would walk by and he'd go, feeling a bit numb, are we? Like this. And because I think he could see my zeal and my energy. I really wanted to make the best of it. But nothing could faze this guy. Nothing. And so eventually I really got into the meditation and all the rest of it. After 3 weeks, I left. And it was really strange, because on the bed was my old leather jacket and my tight, stretchy jeans and my Versace shirt, my Versace crocodile skin belt and my boots. And I looked at it like it was an old identity. Anyways, I get to the train station, I put all of this on, and I got into the car to go to the train station, and tears flooded down my face. And on the station, on the platform, I couldn't stand it any longer, and I took all these clothes off, and I left them on a railing there, and put my joggers on, my horror belt, my loose top.
Wow.
I'm talking hundreds and hundreds of pounds. My leather jacket was like 500 pounds, right? I mean, it was all kind of, but it was an identity I had to let go of.
Oh, okay.
Right? And once I let go of that, I moved more into trying to understand more about the mind. So I started cognitive behavioral therapy, and I started working with clients and working with people in that sense. But whilst I was still doing training and massage and Reiki and all the rest of Shiatsu, and I thought, wow, people are really getting this. And this wasn't self-help.
Right.
And it wasn't just a traditional self-help. It was really trying to get a deeper penetration into what is the motivating principle in this person's life? Because what I was trying to establish was, what is the hidden cry in this person?
Right.
And that's what would come out, was their hidden cry. Eventually that would surface. And then we could work with that. We started to work with that. I used to do it with movement and with talking and giving them exercises. And so that then brought me into coaching. In 1999, I went and did with Coach University. I started coaching, learning about coaching. I thought, oh, okay, but I found it still a bit problematic because it was all about goals and, you know, how people describe it today. It's like, well, you're here, but you want to get there. What we do is help you get from A to B. Well, yeah, there is that, but there was something deeper about it, and this is how I came to Deep Fusion.
Oh, okay.
Right, is to understand there's the inner world. So again, if you take two metaphorical cameras and you film your inner world and then you film your outer world, there usually is an incompatibility of alignment between the two.
Oh, okay. So that's what.
So fusing those together, right, and understanding that if you want to create peace of mind, you've got to create peaceful chemistry.
Ah, okay. So that's part of the work that you do with the people that come to find themselves in their life.
Yeah.
Wow.
Sorry, that was a bit of a, I didn't think I would go that far, but.
No, it's fine because it's very fascinating. I'm always amazed at how evolution works. When you don't have to worry about food and shelter, your evolution is going to be of a psychological and spiritual nature, and that the forces of the universe will sort of, if you're open to it, create experiences that lead you from one place to the next, and the next thing you know, you have a relatively complete package that you can offer other people in terms of healing and helping them get to a place of a more peaceful existence. And it's exactly what you just described, that you allowed yourself to be sort of led toward your destiny, or at least this part of your destiny right now. And it's a great story because, how would you have known how this would have turned out in the beginning, right?
Exactly.
Right. Who works in a gym and then ends up being, helping people mend their wounds? It's not a normal path. And it sounds like in your life you've actually never had a normal sort of in quotes path. That you've always been a bit of an unusual guy and felt the calling of the world in ways that most people would either be too afraid to pursue or wouldn't take seriously. That makes sense.
And I felt subpoenaed.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
It was like there was a universal subpoena.
Uh-huh.
That was organizing and propelling and wiring my soul for growth.
Sure.
In such a way that when I set my feet upon this path, I had no signposts. There were no signposts for me.
Right.
At all to say, this is the destination. No, it said, this is the direction.
Right, right.
Right. Well, you don't know what that destination is going to be. It wasn't until recently when I had that operation and I had that out of the body, that near death experience, that I thought, wow, this is the culmination of all of it.
Right.
This is saying now you have to elevate, you have to refine, you have to take all that you've brought together and then bring that out into the world, because I was always very camera shy. I would never speak up, because I can identify that when I was a kid, I'd be very outspoken, and I was always told by my, by my parents, like, oh, you mustn't say that. That's your, I became almost mute in a way.
Right.
And I recognize where that stems from. Uh-huh. But now it's like, no, I am going to speak up. So
right.
After that NDE, it was like, okay, what you're telling me, there is a, almost like there was a mutual co-shaping that went on between that experience of where I am now and the whole aspect of deep fusion and wanting to be the servant for God, for the cosmos, whatever right. you want to call it.
Yeah.
For the universe, so that I become that agency that can amplify those messages. I don't profess to be a channeler or hear voices. I'm an ordinary guy.
Well,
but what I do think about is I think about the fact that here we are in this, we learn from what our culture teaches us.
Right.
But then there's what our curiosity drives me to discover. But there's also a deeper, much deeper knowledge that I believe is already within us, waiting to be revealed. And I wanted to access that. And it is the knowledge of true nature. It's the knowledge that allows our connection to the source of all life. And I think that knowledge is often hidden or ignored by the rules and expectations of the 3D world.
Right.
Because what I see with people is that when people are traumatized or anxious or worried, their brain is wired for protection as distinct from connection.
Sure.
So it's really about the question I ask myself, how am I relating to myself and how am I relating to the world? Am I embracing my uniqueness? Am I embracing my gifts? Am I embracing the interest that I have in the realms of the unseen realms, in a way, of a spiritual life and presence? Or do I just conform to the norms and standards of what is presented to me? Because it's so clear to me that when you conform, you get confirmed in that.
Right. Yeah, because it's a less fearful way to live, and it's more comfortable for people around you when you don't challenge them and when you don't make them uncomfortable, I guess, for lack of a better way of putting it. I mean, my experience as a psychologist is that the most uncomfortable thing that I can ever do with a group of people that don't really know me is tell them what I do for a living, Peter. I can empty out a room quicker than anybody that you can imagine. All I got to do is tell people what I do for a living. And it's, I have these really awfully sometimes funny experiences with people because, what's the first question that men ask each other when you're meeting a stranger? What do you do for a living, right?
What do you do?
You're not going to ask somebody how big their penis is because that would be rude, right? So you're going to ask them how big their wallet is because we have to figure out some way of sort of feeling comfortable in the presence of other people. So, the first question a man is going to ask another man, generally speaking, probably not you or me, but other people, is you want to put them in a box, right? So what do you do for a living? And I had the... I had the experience the other day. I was in an outpatient surgery where I was having a procedure done, and I'm laying on the operating table, and they're just getting ready to anesthetize me. And the nurse standing next to me, we're having a chat, and all these people are super friendly. They're really nice. And she says to me, "What do you do for a living?" And I think to myself, oh, fuck, I can't tell these people that. I can't answer that question because if I do, they're all going to want to leave the room and I need them to stay in the room, right? I need the anesthesiologist and the nurses and everybody to, to do what I need them to do. So I say to this woman, "I'm not going to tell you." And she said, "What?" And I said, "Well, I can't tell you because if I do, you're going to want to leave as quick as possible." And she said to me, are you a proctologist? Right? And I said, no. And she said, well, that would make me uncomfortable, right? If I knew that you looked up people's rear ends all day long, that's kind of a weird way to, right? And I said, no, it's worse than that. She said, what could be worse than being a proctologist, right? We're having a sort of a playful conversation. And I said to her, I really can't tell you because I need all of you to stay in the room because I really need your help. That's why we're here. And I'm going to be in under anesthesia in a few minutes, so you don't need to worry about what I do for a living. And she said, well, you have to tell me. I said, I'm a psychologist. And the room went completely silent.
Oh, gosh.
Everybody's sphincter went on lockdown. And they all looked at me like, oh, fuck. Right? And I said, this is why I don't tell people what I do, because you're going to get scared and you want to get away from me because you're going to assume I can figure out your secrets, which, you know, I can appreciate. And everybody else is getting nervous because, look, who doesn't have things that they want to hide because they feel ashamed of themselves?
Right? Oh, absolutely. That's a question I ask myself.
Right.
Am I going to accept myself as I am?
Right.
Am I going to lie to myself? Am I going to hide? Am I going to pretend? Uh-huh. Because what lies am I telling myself?
Right.
Or do I let others define my worth and my identity?
Right. Yeah. So, you know, I tell that story because I thought it was pretty funny. Luckily, they all stayed in the room because they put me under anesthesia like 2 minutes later. And so I don't think that they were afraid that I was going to figure out what was going on while I was unconscious. So, but it's a really common experience because I think, you know, most people live in fear and most people are really afraid to take a look at who they are because they feel like whatever has happened to them in the form of abuse or whatever didn't happen for them in the form of neglect, that if you're a kid, there's no way that you're not going to blame yourself for that. And so most of the people that come to see me already feel really badly about themselves. They already feel like there's something wrong with them and that nobody is going to love them and that that whatever that their trauma is who they are. And I just did a podcast that I would love for you to consider listening to, and it was all about healing trauma with love. Mm. Because part of what I've come to learn is that you are not your trauma. And if you identify with it as being a reflection of who you are, you're going to be stuck with it for the rest of your life. But if you recognize that it is not who you are, it is what happened either to you or not, what didn't happen for you, or maybe some combination of the both, but it does not have to define who you are as a person, that you can heal those wounds when you can step away from believing that it's your fault and that you must have done something to deserve it. So, again, I know I'm kind of blabbing away here, but I'm assuming that part of what you realize with people in the way that you look at them and help them come to look at themselves is that they have very mistaken ideas about who they are and especially how they feel about themselves deep down inside. Is that a fair thing to say?
Oh, absolutely. It's a distorted perception of, you know, when they look in the mirror, they look at the reflection back to them as distinct from them shaping the reflection that they want to see. Because instead of looking at or trying to solve the problem, it's really more about matching the frequency of the solution. So it's accessing the realm where the problem doesn't exist. So you become less gravitational and more radiational about it. Because what people try and do is they try to, who was it? Was it Einstein who said that? You can't solve a problem. What did he say? You can't solve a problem where it started in the first place or something like that. So you instead of trying to solve that problem, you have to match the frequency of the solution. Okay. Because there is a realm where the problem doesn't exist. If you try to fix it in what we call the 3D world,
right?
Then you're going to fight against it. I mean, what I've learned is true knowing, not a belief, but true knowing, for me, is one of the most powerful forces in the universe because it fills you with light and love. Belief is not something that you have or don't have. It's something you develop and cultivate.
Right.
So it's a mercy. It's immersing myself in the realm that I want to believe in, but I also need to let it seep into my sinews, touch me, move me, teach me until I receive its codes and its messages. So I need to align with its frequency and vibration until I receive its grace and blessing.
And I think if you look at your life, it's a really prime example of what you're describing, right? That you're living proof that what you're describing can happen if you are open to allowing yourself to be led toward healing and finding your true purpose in life and then being of service. Because I believe that that when I met you, the first thing that I noticed right away is that your version of love that you present to the world is really very sweet. That you're very that there's a kindness about you that I think you may take for granted. I don't know if you do or you don't, but I think that comes out of this feeling that you're describing, is that Peter's version of love helps people heal. And I think that that's really what you bring to the table. Whatever words you want to use to describe it, I think it's something that came to you as a result of you being led toward your own healing process. You know, some of it was wandering the world as a younger man, and some of it was being introduced to the right people at the right time. But if you look back at your life, there's some really really salient moments that you were led toward that helped you get to a place where you can now be of service to others. And I'm assuming that's part of what you try to help other people do. Is that fair to say?
Absolutely, yeah. It's you know, when people present, it's usually, what I see is they're showing me the frame.
Right.
And they've adorned the frame with all these different things that are not enough, or trauma, or whatever it is they put on their frame.
Right.
I'm saying, okay, those are all there. Okay, but don't let that define you. But here's a different pair of glasses,
right?
Not rose tinted. Now I want you to look through the frame and look at the incredible arena of possibilities that are constructed for you, because it's an open space. There's a new genesis of possibilities for you. What are they? Because if you tear a wall down, you can either look at the debris or you can step into the space.
Right.
Where do you want to be? And yes, granted, stepping into the space takes courage, takes an intention. It's scary. It's all those things that that can prevent you as distinct from promote you. But we've got to not wait for the hand to reach down. We've got to reach up.
Okay.
Too many of us are waiting for the hand to reach down.
I'm sorry, I didn't understand what you just asked the question. Say it again.
I said too many of us are waiting for the hand to reach come down.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. I'm sorry, I didn't.
As distinct from us reaching up.
Yes. I think that's absolutely correct, that we are taught to be reactive and wait.
Yes.
Instead of living an intentional life where you are being proactive at every moment that you can, because the more that you're willing to take responsibility for yourself and take yourself out of that reactive place and into a proactive place where you're trying to advocate your own healing and helping others, the more chance that what you're looking for from your life is going to come to you. So I'm always encouraging people to consider stepping away from their reactive place, especially when I'm working with couples. People become extremely reactive to the people that they love and then become really defensive, and they stop listening to each other because they're so busy trying to prove to the other person that they're right that they're not even listening anymore. And so part of what I think is important is for people to realize they've allowed themselves to go to a very defensive, reactive place instead of doing the best they can to take care of the people that they love and to shift away from believing that the other person doesn't love you or is trying to hurt you, and realize that, you know, if somebody says to you, I'm lonely or I want more of you, they're not saying that to you to criticize you. It's a huge compliment. Now, we don't always say it in a very complimentary way. Like, you know, what the fuck is wrong with you? How come you don't spend enough time with me and all that sort of thing? So the compliment gets lost in the way that it's expressed. But I really believe that it's important for, like you say, how many people are listened to and really, really have somebody in their life that's willing to listen to what they have to say. It's a very rare thing. You know, before we got started, you were reminding me that part of your philosophy is that listening is a form of a really powerful form of expressing love. And I agree with you. When I wander through the world, I see a lot of really lonely, disenfranchised people that are trying to figure out, you know, what to do with themselves. And it doesn't matter how much money they have. I live in an incredibly wealthy community. And, you know, I see people that have more money than God, and it doesn't really make that much difference if their lives are devoid of people that they love and feel a healthy connection to. So, again, I guess part of the journey is learning how to be proactive in the way that you take care of yourself and taking yourself out of that reactive place of being a little kid and feeling helpless.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's so well said. And I think it, you know, the question that comes up for me is, where do I live? In, you know, where is home for me? Because if my impressions are just of this world, and don't get me wrong, I'm not just being ethereal about it, but let's bring it down to the material, because we, in this dimension, you know, we call it the 3D dimension, but in this dimension, we feel separate from everything we experience. So we tend to identify ourselves by our appearance, our occupation, our possessions, our social status, all the things I've done.
Right.
And then we compete with others for limited resources and opportunities. And there are many examples of this.
Yeah.
So we fear missing out or not having enough. We rely on our five senses to navigate the world because we believe that our thoughts have no power over our reality,
right,
and that everything happens by chance. So if we look at it from a spiritual context, the 3D dimension is the realm of the ego, the lower self or the personality. And I'm not saying do away with the ego and crush it and get rid of it. No, absolutely not. But it's where we learn to master the physical plane and overcome the challenges of survival, because we're wired for survival. So in a practical context, this dimension is the realm of action, is the realm of achievement and productivity. So it's where we set those goals, we make plans, we work hard to accomplish them. But it's also the place where we face problems, conflicts, obstacles that test our skills and abilities. So in a global context, this dimension is the realm of politics, economics, social systems, and it's where we create the laws and the rules and the structures to organize and govern our societies. But it's also where we encounter issues such as poverty and inequality and violence and environmental degradation. These all threaten our well-being and our stability. Now, if we go up Jacob's ladder and we go into the next dimension of that, that's where we feel much more, we start to awaken. It's what I call soul esteem rather than just self-esteem.
Right.
We begin to awaken to the idea that, you know, you hear it all the time, we're all connected, we're all one, but there's more to life than meets the eye. And what happened for me was I started to notice the subtle signals and intuitions that could guide me towards stepping through the frame into those future possibilities.
You know, Peter,
and that's where I'm
sorry to interrupt just for a moment, but I think that it's important if I can to describe what you're saying in a slightly different context, which is, if you live your life externally focused, you're going to be living a life of fear and anxiety and dissatisfaction. Yes. And it, to me, what it sounds like you're saying is that the more you're connected to yourself, not in a self-centered way, but in a centered within yourself way, that then your intuition becomes the guidepost in your life.
Yes.
And that your and that your spiritual connection to God or whatever, however you want to describe it, gets enhanced, because I really believe that the voice of God lives in our intuition, and that the more we're connected to it, the more that it helps us both in healing ourselves and being able to be present to other people in a way that also helps them not feel so alone in the world, and if they choose, to help themselves heal. So again, I apologize for interrupting, but I think that you're saying.
Yeah, I am, and you know, building off of that is that it's the recognition that thoughts are powerful and right. they can shape your reality.
Oh, without question, especially.
Right?
I mean, that's where that concept of manifesting your heart's desire comes into the picture.
Yeah.
You know, there's lots of books and all kinds of stuff that's been written on manifesting, you know, your desires. But I think that the reason why those books fail to help people is because it doesn't take into account how you feel about yourself deep down inside. Because you can do all the manifesting that you want to, but if you don't feel like you deserve what you're asking, it's not going to happen. So
negates it.
Right. So part of the work that you and I have chosen is to help people get to a place where they can heal and realize that they've been blaming the wrong person their whole lives, or at least taking it out on the wrong person, and get to a place where they can accept the abundance that the world can bring them if they can allow themselves to feel that love that you and I are talking about.
At least, and that's where I had to make that move from blame and avoidance into truth and responsibility.
Right. Absolutely.
Because they live on the same line. You
yes.
know, we can blame the economy. We can blame, you know, our partners. We can blame our government. All these things we can attribute blame to.
Right.
But do we step up and stand tall?
Right.
And become responsible, not reactive, responsible.
Uh-huh.
So that we can then start to shape circumstances as distinct from circumstances shaping us.
Right.
And yes, we're going to experience duality and polarity, absolutely. But can we have more compassion? Can we have more understanding for ourselves?
Absolutely. Right?
Because this dimension for me is the realm of the soul, the higher self,
right.
or the essence.
Yep.
So I think that when we discover or uncover our true nature, our purpose, our potential, then we can, you know, we can exercise the dimensionality of the realm of imagination, creativity, innovation. We can explore new ideas, perspectives, and solutions that can improve our lives and the world, because it's where, and you see this, where people are expressing themselves through art or music or poetry that have a complete permeation. Look at the Beatles.
Right.
They, even today, they had complete permeation. What do I mean by that? Is that people are still buying,
right.
you know, their music. Gandhi had complete
sure.
permeation.
Yeah.
Right? So if you're not at that level, if you're thinking I must permeate,
right.
you're not in the grip of power. You're in the grip of compulsion,
right? Right,
and that's totally different, because that's not power, that's force.
Yes.
So I think that, you know, when we see these expressions, then we can celebrate the differences and the similarities as human beings, because this is where we encounter movements such as environmentalism, human rights, social justice,
right.
global citizenship,
sure.
that all aim to create a more harmonious and sustainable world.
Peter, you couldn't have said it better if you wanted to. We're running a little bit short on time. I try to keep my podcast to around an hour.
Okay.
And I don't believe that you and I are finished. So what I would love to do is to ask you if there's anything, at least for this episode of the podcast, that you haven't had the opportunity to express that you think is important. You're a very really interesting person, and the way that you describe things is really very vivid. And I want to do this again, but I do have to call this one short. So is there anything okay. that, is there anything else that you think is really important to say to my listeners that you haven't had a chance to really express today on this episode?
Well, I want to say that, you know, in the dimension that I live in, and I believe others have access to it, is that we can transcend duality and separation and realize that we are one with everything that we experience. We can live in a state of love and joy, peace and gratitude when we align our actions with our vision and our higher purpose. And yeah. I think that we co-create these new realities with others who share our values and our goals, where we no longer fear or judge anything or anyone. And for me, it's about trusting in the divine plan and flow with the universal intelligence. Right. And this is the realm of God or source or the biofield or whatever you want to call it. And this is where there's that we merge with the essence of all creation. We access infinite wisdom, power, and abundance that is available to us at all times. And I think from a practical, in a practical context, I think that the realm of manifestation, transformation, and ascension, it's where we manifest our dreams into reality with an ease and a grace. We don't have to fight gravity. And it's also where we finally, it's also where we transform ourselves and the world around us into higher expressions of light and love. And I think globally, I would say that this is where we can step into the realm of harmony and cooperation and service, because this is where we can live in harmony with ourselves and others, nature and God.
Right. So, Peter, this is chapter one, if that's okay with you. And I want to do as many chapters as you are willing, because I just find it really fascinating to have a conversation with you. And I think that my audience is going to really appreciate the dialogue that you and I have together. So I just want to express my gratitude to you for your willingness to keep this relationship going. It's been really fun again today. And we're going to go from here.
Well, thank you so much for the opportunity, Dr. Dan. It's just been fascinating. Thank you for giving me the platform where I can voice all these things. I really do appreciate it. It's been an honor and a privilege really to speak with you.
We appreciate our listeners and are interested in your comments and suggestions. Feel free to email us at fearmeoutpodcast@gmail.com. If you are interested in becoming a sponsor for this podcast, please email us at fearmeoutpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you for listening. See you next time.